waiting for the PowerPoint to come up, I will start out with a few biblical puns, which is my tradition, because very hard to do with good like a medicine. So, we'll try a few ark puns. What bird did Noah use to help him build the ark? What bird did Noah use to help him build the ark? Well, he used the crane, of course. And what were the two most dangerous animals aboard Noah's ark? So dangerous that Noah demanded that they both be housed in iron cages. No? That's a good guess, though. The two most dangerous animals, the salient part being aboard Noah's ark, were the beaver and the woodpecker. Okay. Now, why was everybody afraid to play cards aboard Noah's ark? Well, they were all afraid to cut the deck. Okay. And what lights did Noah put on the ark? Well, he used floodlights, of course. Maybe just one more. How did Noah earn the distinctive title of being the world's most successful stockbroker in history? Well, Noah was the only man in history who was able to float his stock despite the fact that the entire world's assets were in liquidation. Pretty good for a man in his day. Now, one thing I do want to point out, I have my good friend and fellow scholar here tonight, Pastor Dan Dusselet, and he is a treasure in your community. He is incredibly well-versed in Christian apologetics, and he's currently teaching an enrichment course, which means you don't get credit for it, but for personal enrichment and gaining more knowledge, he's teaching a course here at the Great Basin College, and he'll be teaching Wednesday night at 7. Would you mind just standing and telling a few things about that? I would fully endorse this man's teaching. He's a great asset to your community in Christian apologetics.
Last quarter, I got to teach on Christian Holocaust. That was a good one. And this quarter, Christian Science. The professor at the college was thrilled that I'm doing this. I mean, that was...
Amen.
Just trying to get the truth out as much as I can to the community. So, thank you, Dr.
You're very welcome. Okay, without any further ado, tonight we're going to be looking at the question, is there a monkey in your family tree? And that may sound somewhat facetious, but unfortunately it's not a joke. It is taught as fact in our high schools and colleges and universities today. The Bible says that we as Christians are supposed to give an answer to everyone who asks us a reason for the hope that's within us. And when people say, why do you believe in Adam and Eve? Why do you believe in Genesis and creation? When science shows us man is just an animal, evolved from a bestial ancestry and ape men and everything, that's why I'm here tonight, so we'll be able to answer those questions. The Bible also says to earnestly contend for the gospel in these last days. One of the biggest stumbling blocks to accepting the gospel is that many people believe the Bible, God's word, has been rendered ineffective because it's historically and scientifically inaccurate. It's just a myth. Therefore, they have no obligation to believe what it has to say. So the Bible tells us, earnestly contend for that truth. It often starts in defending Genesis. If you want to defend the gospel of Christ, you start with the defense of his word in Genesis. That's the foundation for everything. And the Bible says that we are to refute the gainsayers, not ignore them. For too long, the church has ignored this problem of evolution and you know, our children at this rate, the attrition in the church is terrible. Over 2/3 of our children raised in church, raised in Sunday school their whole life, within a year or two after leaving their home, they blow off the Christian faith, especially if they go to a secular university. So we want to immunize people, give people answers, be able to contend for the faith, and that's what this is all about. Now then, the evolutionary trees in our textbook look very convincing. You know, it's in a science book, so it's got to be science. Well, not necessarily. If it's scientific, then it should have certain facts that can be established. The idea is that God did not create man in his image. Man is the product of a long evolutionary ancestry that started with the chance and naturalistic origin of the first living cell, the first species. Now, if they can't get that species, then it can't evolve into all the other species. So it's not a minor problem. It's a fatal stake through the heart of their whole theory if they cannot account for that. But based on everything we know, it is mathematically, chemically, physically, and thermodynamically impossible to get inanimate matter to turn into a living and reproducing cell. This single cell is more complex than any machine that man has ever dreamed of creating, yet is able to build itself, maintain itself, repair itself automatically, and make copies of itself, virtual exact copies, and continue to do that for thousands of years without any outside maintenance and repair. Now, in our technology, the more complex we make things, the easier it is for them to break down and require repair. For example, our F-22 Raptor, the most sophisticated fighter jet in the world today, for every mission it flies, it has a mandatory 12 hours on the ground for inspection, maintenance, and repair. And if they didn't do that, they wouldn't be flying very long. They'd be crashing all over. But God can make a machine so tiny that it's microscopic, and it can build itself, maintain itself, repair itself, and reproduce itself, something that none of our machines can do, autonomous self-replication, and keep on doing it for millennia after millennia after millennia without any outside maintenance or repair. With men, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. So they can't account for this at all. They put it there as a bluff, as if, oh, we can account for that first cell by evolution, and that's the seed from which the tree of evolution grew clear up to the highest species, man himself. But the evolutionists that are honest, such as the one I quote here, admit that we have no seed for this tree, not based on science. Everything we know in science shows you cannot get a living and reproducing cell out of inanimate matter. For example, Paul Davies, a very, very well-educated, very knowledgeable scientist from Australia in the field of the origin of life studies, he said, it's a shame that there are precious few hard facts when it comes to the origin of life. But how part has everybody stumped? Nobody knows how a mixture of lifeless chemicals spontaneously organized themselves into the first cell. That's the truth. Why don't we hear that in our textbooks? Well, if we did, instead of showing the first cell there that supposedly evolved, there'd be a big question mark. We don't know how in the world, based on what we know scientifically, that could happen. So a question mark should be there, not the first cell. Then we have another major fatal problem. The trunk of the tree that supports these other branches does not exist in the fossil record, because the fossil record jumps from single-celled creatures like bacteria and plankton and algae all the way up to multi-million-celled creatures of every major category of life known as the phyla. And there's nothing in between, no ancestors, no transitions, nothing. It's known as Darwin's enigma, Darwin's puzzle. And in his day, he said he had no way of explaining it. He hoped the missing transitions and ancestors would show up in the future. But now, well more than 150 years after he proposed his theory, there's still nothing. And it exists in the living world, too. We have single-celled creatures, but then there's no two-celled, three-celled, four-celled, five-celled, 10-celled, 100-celled, 150-celled, 1,000-celled, 100,000-celled, finally, multi-million-celled creatures. This transition had to happen if evolution is true. But there's absolutely no evidence in the living world or in the fossil record for it. That's inconceivable if evolution really took place. We find billions of beautifully preserved fossils, including single-celled, soft-bodied creatures. They got preserved, but nothing in between. Now, if God created single cells and then he created all the other creatures, the multi-billion-celled creatures, we'd predict there'd be a big gap there. It's a prediction of creation, but it's sure not a prediction of evolution. They have to believe, in spite of the fact that there's literally no evidence there, that evolution could have taken place. They have to believe on the basis of evidence that does not exist. Try that in a court of law. Well, Your Honor, we don't have any evidence that the defendant is guilty, but we figured that he's a criminal genius and he did the crime in just the right way, that he left no incriminating evidence. Therefore, we want you to find him guilty. The judge says, man, I'm going to throw the book at you. Don't ever come back into my court with nothing but prejudice accusations against the defendant. If you don't have any evidence which you admit, then you have no case. And until they have evidence, they have no case. They have no right to even talk about this. They haven't earned the right. You got to have that first seed, or you can't have anything else. You got to have a trunk of the tree, or you can't support anything else. So here we have two fatal flaws that none of them have ever answered since Darwin's day. When people say, well, why don't you believe in evolution? I say, well, I don't have to believe any theory that has one fatal flaw. This theory has two big ones that nobody has been able to address or answer in more than 150 years. So you have to earn the right for me to listen to your pathetic theory. You solve these two problems first. This is a big problem. It's kind of like if we have a guy laying up here prostrate, and I come up and I look at him with my evolutionist friend, and on his shirt it says, I am Mr. Evolution. And I tell my evolutionist friend, you know, I think Mr. Evolution here has bought the farm and kicked the bucket. He says, oh, no, it can't be. And I say, yeah, because you'll notice there's a big stake right through his heart. And that's usually fatal. In fact, it always is. The stake through the heart is their inability to explain the first cell, the first species. Therefore, it can't evolve into all the other species. That's no minor problem. Now, they try to say, oh, yeah, but we got all this other evidence up here. Wait a minute, wait a minute. You can't argue about anything else unless you explain this fatal flaw. You might say, well, look, his fingers are twitching, his toes are twitching. Well, as you know, with the old chicken with its head cut off scenario, nerves can fire off even after your head is cut off. You're not going to live, you're not going to survive, but the fact that you twitch for a while is insignificant. I say, forget the insignificant twitching. You explain how he's going to live when there's a stake through his heart. And there's another fatal flaw. Where his neck is supposed to be, there's a gap. There's a gap between his shoulders and his head. That's what you call a fatal gap, okay? That's this gap here, a huge gap that can't possibly exist if evolution really took place. It would leave some evidence, and there's nothing that they've been able to find in more than a century and a half. So I don't want to talk about insignificant things like his fingers and his toes are twitching, okay? You explain how he can live when there's a stake through his heart, you know? If the heart is destroyed, the lifeblood can't flow to all the other organs. So they're dead too. Just like if you can't get the first species, it can't evolve into all the other species. It's fatal for the whole theory, like the stake through the heart, even though it only destroyed the heart, is fatal to the whole body. And if you got your head severed from your body, that's a fatal gap. You got to explain how he can live there. If you can't explain these two fatal flaws, I don't want to hear any other theory about his toes twitching or anything like that. Any of this other stuff is insignificant. Come back when you've explained these two fatal flaws, and then maybe you've earned the right to talk about your theory. But I don't have to listen to any theory that has two fatal flaws. Nobody does. And yours has two big ones that nobody in the world, no matter how smart, has been able to solve in more than 150 years. So don't tell me I have to believe in your theory. It doesn't make sense. I tell them, come back when you solve these two. I'd be glad to talk. You know what? They never come back. Because the most brilliant people in the world who have tried to tackle these issues have ended up in abject failure. It cannot be explained on the basis of evolution, but it is predicted on the basis of creation. Now then, not only do we not have that, we don't have the seed, we don't have the trunk of the tree to support the branches, we don't even have connecting branches on this tree. It's a total facade. And I quote in that regard T. Neville George, well, this is about the gap with between the single-celled and multi-million-celled creatures. T. Neville George, he stated that granted an evolutionary origin of the main groups of animals and not an act of special creation, see, creation would explain it, he said the absence of any record whatsoever of a single member of any of the phyla in the Precambrian rocks remains as inexplicable on orthodox grounds as it was to Darwin. This was Darwin's biggest headache. George Gaylord Simpson, the greatest evolutionist of the 20th century, he said that this problem is the major mystery of the history of life. It's not a mystery to us. It's exactly what you'd expect to see if biblical creation is true. Now then, we don't have connecting branches here, as no less an expert than Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard University, a Marxist, atheist, card-carrying Marxist evolutionist. He was, prior to his death in 2002, probably the world's leading spokesman for the theory of evolution, so he's no small potatoes. But he admitted the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. Paleontology is the study of the fossil record. So he said, laypersons aren't allowed to know our trade secret. We don't have any evidence. We don't have branches connecting in this alleged tree. So the evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and the nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, in other words, wishful thinking, not science. However reasonable, that's not the evidence of fossils. So according to no less an expert in the fossil record than Dr. Gould himself, they don't have any branches connecting on this tree. So you have to ask yourself the question, what kind of a legitimate scientific tree has no seed to grow from, no trunk to support it, and no connecting branches? Well, an imaginary tree, a fairy tale tree, a wannabe tree, but certainly not a scientific tree. What we see is exactly what the Genesis tells us. God created distinct forms of plants and animals to reproduce after their own family, their own kind, and that's why there's gaps in between, because there never was any evolution from one to the other. They were distinctly, separately created as different families. That's what the record shows. Now, nonetheless, evolutionists use the supposed tree of evolution to justify quotes like this in our textbooks. You are an animal and share a common heritage with earthworms. Wonderful. That's not exactly the greatest thing for the human ego. You know, you're the end product of this equation, slime plus time equals you, from goo to you by way of the zoo. And of course, when we ask the most basic philosophical questions that man has pondered from the beginning of time, where did I come from? Who am I? Why am I here? What is the purpose of my life? How do we determine what is right and what is wrong? And what's going to happen to me when I die? These are the most basic philosophical questions, but they're really all tied up in this question. How did you come to exist? Because how you came to exist determines your identity, who you are, why you're here, and where you're going. And if you don't get the truth about how you came to be, you cannot successfully answer those other major philosophical questions of life. They only want you to hear one side because they can't stand up on their own 2 feet. It's defended by the courts. Their cronies in the courts prop it up, because if it had to compete in the open marketplace of ideas, it'd get shot down every single time. Nonetheless, we have James Rachels, who I quoted this morning, in his book, Created from Animals, The Moral Implications of Darwinism. Not only do we have no dignity and purpose and value, not only when we die, if evolution is true, because we're just a bag of chemicals thrown together by chance over millions of years, we have no spiritual nature that can survive the grave and wherein we can have eternal life in heaven with God. No, if that's the case, when you die, that's the end of everything. You will never even remember you ever existed or achieved anything. What a philosophy of hopelessness and despair. But it also has big moral implications. If we're made in the image of God, then you have intrinsic value because you are made in his image. And God values you enough to pay the infinite king's ransom for you, because even in your fallen, sinful state, you are made in the image of God and are destined by his will, if you'll accept it, to be joint heirs with Jesus Christ, the bride of Christ, the children of the Father for all eternity. And we'll have a kingdom of love where everybody will love God and love their neighbor as themselves forever. And what a glorious eternity that will be. But if, on the other hand, we're just evolved from scum and finally apes to man, then when we ask the question, how should we treat other people? They're not made in the image of God. They don't have intrinsic value like the Bible says. What makes us different from animals? Well, we're more intelligent. What if you have an accident and you're mentally impaired, or you were born, you know, retarded or something? Oh, well, then you're not so smart anymore. You know, maybe an African gray parrot or a crow might be as smart as you, in which case you're no better than animals. And so James Rachel said, well, let's ask what we ought to do in that case. He said, what are we to say about them, speaking of the mentally impaired? According to the doctrine which we are considering, Darwinism, would be that their status is that of mere animals. And perhaps we should go on to conclude that they may be used as non-human animals or used perhaps as laboratory subjects or as food. Yeah. Well, if you're not made in the image of God and you're just an animal, is there anything illogical with this conclusion? Not really. And if evolution is true, there is no basis for any absolute morality. Why does your evolved brain thrown together by a bunch of accidents have any more authority than my evolved brain that was thrown together by a bunch of accidents to say what is right or what is wrong? There really isn't any right or wrong. There's just comfort or discomfort. There's just survival or extinction. But absolute right and wrong, it doesn't exist in an evolutionary world. Because when you get rid of God, the infinite one, the one who is perfect in knowledge, the one who's infallible and cannot make any mistakes, then you can't appeal to an ultimate authority to say this is absolutely right or wrong. It's just your evolved brain versus mine. And then it just boils down to might makes right. If I get a bigger army than yours, I'll enforce my morality on you until somebody with a bigger army forces me to bow before their morality, but there is no absolute morality, because only with God is that possible. So when you accept evolution, you give up a lot. Dignity, value, purpose, hope beyond the grave, and any basis for any kind of absolute morality at all. Now, there are three major strikes against evolution that evolutionists actually admit. Strike number one, Darwinian evolution is impossible to observe. According to Theodosius Dobzhansky, who is believed by many to be the greatest evolutionist biologist of the 20th century, and he said it's impossible for the simple reason that Darwinian change, where we have one family, large category, family, order, class, phyla, change into another, that takes millions of years, and no scientist or observer can live for millions of years to see it happen. Science is what you can see and test and repeat and prove by repeated experimentation to be true, repeated observation, but nobody lives long enough to observe this at all. It can't be proved by the scientific method. Nonetheless, they believe it and call it a fact, but it's certainly not a scientific fact if it cannot be observed and tested and repeated. That's why he used the word impossible. That's his word, not mine. Strike number two, the mutation selection mechanism is effectively dead, quote unquote, according to Dr. Stephen Gould of Harvard University. He admitted that random changes in the genetic language would be like taking computer code and just randomly typing helter-skelter and expect it to improve and get better. It's ridiculous on the face of it. There's no experiment that shows that's true. There's no mathematics that shows that's true. So he said, we got to come up with a better mechanism. This is obviously ridiculous, but he never did before he died in 2002. But how many of you know that Stephen Gould is today a creationist? How many of you knew that? You see, when you die, you meet your maker. We all become creationists. You kind of come about it the hard way. But since we're all going to become creationists in the end, we might as well become one before. And it works out a whole lot better that way. All right, strike number three. According to Dr. Colin Patterson, a former senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History, which has the greatest assemblage of fossils from all over the world, more so than any other natural museum history in the world. This guy was a senior paleontologist. He had access to all these fossils. He wrote a book on evolution. The title was simply Evolution. And in this book, he gave not a single drawing or a photo or any indication of a transitional fossil. When asked why, he said, well, if I knew of any, I certainly would have put them in my book. But I don't know of any that are truly legitimate and watertight. One of the greatest experts with the greatest amount of fossils at his disposal couldn't find any. Wow. Well, he is a rather honest evolutionist, I must say. There are a few that they will argue for, but it's just a handful. And there should be millions in every museum around the world if evolution were really true. There's just a few very disputable ones that even he did not feel convinced by. But as far as watertight, he said there's not a single watertight one that we could really make our case on. So that's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out. But Niles Eldridge of the American Museum of Natural History, and he's an expert in the fossil record, he said, you know, the fossil record really doesn't show evolution. But we have one last hope, and that is here, from an alleged ape-like ancestor to man. There we have quite a few. You look in the textbooks, we have quite a few. That'll save our bacon, because even though we don't have them anywhere else, we do at least have them. That proves evolution. Well, if this, under cross-examination, falls apart, they have nothing whatsoever. So, isn't it interesting? You'll notice that up here, they have drawings. They don't have any photographs of ape man. They seem to be hard to find and photograph. And these drawings are often based on incredibly fragmentary evidence. I always say the first thing when somebody comes up with a new ape man or whatever, I say, I want to see the real bones for myself. I don't want to just listen to your cartoon drawing or your artist's conception of what it looks like. I want to see what you actually found to determine with my own logic whether you can make these kind of drawings based on fragments of bones. Because it's an amazing thing in the fossil record. We find plenty of ape fossils that are complete or nearly complete. We find a lot of human fossils that are ancient, but they're complete or nearly complete. But in the twilight zone in between, where it's supposed to be half man, half ape, they have just fragments. And from these incredible fragments, they make these beautiful pictures. So always demand to look at the evidence yourself. Now, they have a terrible history of track record. You know, I would say you got to come up with a better track record before you want me to blindly trust what your artists say here, because you really have a bad track record of making mistakes. One, back in the 1920s, Nebraska Man, depicted in the Illustrated London News, and he looks rather, you know, brutish and bestial. He's carrying a club and a stone implement, and his wife is there with him. Well, this was actually used in the famous Scopes Monkey Trial in 1925 against William Jennings Bryan, who was standing up in favor of the biblical account of creation. They said, look, your own home state of Nebraska, they found an ape man that proves your myth of Adam and Eve isn't even true. Well, did they really? You see, when they made all these claims, even in a court of law, and put this in the textbooks, they did not have in their possession a complete skeleton or a complete skull or even a complete jaw. All they did have in its entirety was a single molar tooth. It was the tooth and the whole tooth, but nothing but the tooth. Okay? You kind of have to wonder how they get the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth out of a single tooth. But I think I have figured out their methodology. It goes like this. The tactics used to ascertain the details of the sketch: if you squeeze a tooth long enough and hard enough, you can force it to confess to anything. They just squeezed that tooth until it hollered and told them anything they wanted to hear. For example, somehow that tooth knew this man walked semi-erect. I don't know what tooth could tell you a man's posture, but apparently it can if it's squeezed hard enough. It knew he had enough intellect in his primitive brain there to know how to make a club and a stone implement. Not only did it know everything about him, by golly, it even knew what his wife looked like right there. Well, it knew everything about this man and his family from a single tooth. Well, what happened here is classic. It's happened over and over and over again in the history of their trying to find ape men. They find fragmentary evidence in the extreme. They make grandiose claims, put pictures in the textbooks, use them in a court of law even. Then more complete evidence is found, and lo and behold, it wasn't even an ape. It was a non-ape creature all to begin with. That's what happened here. Full examination results were finally published in Scientific American magazine, December 16, 1927. It turns out that Nebraska man turned out to be neither an ape nor man. It actually turned out to be a pig. Technically a peccary, which is a pig-like animal, but definitely not an ape man. You know, so they would have saved themselves a great deal of embarrassment if they had not been so pig-headed, if you'll pardon the pun, about trying to use this in the Scopes monkey trial and in the textbooks of that time. Now, another example after that was Piltdown Man. This was actually earlier, from 1912 to 1953. Let's see if I've gotten this right here. Yeah, there we go. Piltdown Man was based on fossil specimens found by Charles Dawson near Piltdown, England in 1912, same year the Titanic sunk, by the way. Some skeptic says this was the find that was the iceberg that sunk the Titanic of Christianity, because it's proved we have a bestial ancestry, Adam and Eve are a myth, and therefore the Bible is a myth. Well, not so quick. Let's again demand to look at all the evidence. Well, what they found was a skullcap that looked rather human and a jawbone that looked very ape-like except for the teeth. The teeth had a wear pattern that would be more human-like than ape-like. And they found them together. They said, oh my goodness, here it appears to have the skull cap like a human, the jaw characteristics of an ape. It must be an ape man. Well, the whole world went wild with excitement. And we find that from 1912 to 1953, Piltdown Man reigned supreme in our textbooks and museums. Scores of books, pamphlets, and articles were published about Piltdown Man. Some of the most famous scientists in the world at the time fully endorsed Piltdown Man. Now, these guys, you know, they look so educated, so erudite. Oh, certainly these scientists could not be mistaken, but every last one of them were. This was actually a deliberate fraud. Somebody had taken these bones that weren't even real fossils. They weren't ancient fossils. Somebody had painted them, you know, with iron salts to make them look like they were ancient stained fossils, placed them at the excavation site in the hopes that when they were recovered, an ape man would be resurrected out of them, which is exactly what happened. But by the 1950s, they came up with a new dating method based on absorption of fluoride out of the environment into the bones. And you could tell relatively how old it was by how much fluoride supposedly had absorbed into it. Well, they tested for fluoride. It had no more than you'd find in a living creature. So they ran up the red flag. This maybe is not as old as they thought. They had presumed it was at least a half a million years old based on evolutionary speculations. So then, they ran further tests, and with no more than a magnifying glass, they looked at the teeth. They saw that these teeth had distinct wear marks on them made by a hand file. Somebody had filed what turned out to be orangutan teeth trying to make them look more human. Piltdown Man was 100% deliberate forgery and fraud. And yet it had for 40 years fooled the world's greatest experts in this field. What was the problem? A lack of education? No, they all had PhDs. It was a lack of an open mind. This was the goose that laid the golden egg. When Darwin postulated his theory in 1859, they looked and looked all over trying to find an ape man. Finally, in the 20th century, they thought they'd found it. And boy, they didn't want to look the gift horse in the mouth, literally. They didn't want to look too close at the teeth with the magnifying glass, because then you find out it's a fraud and a forgery. So, Piltdown Man is now recognized as one of the most spectacular and longest-enduring frauds in the history of modern science. So when they say, oh, you got to believe what the scientists say, I'll say, look at their track record. It's horrific. These guys are not immune to the human frailties of pride and prejudice and preconceived ideas. They often let their preconceived ideas and belief in atheism and desire not to believe in God lead them in taking the most trivial evidence and putting it in a textbook, using it in a court of law. This was also used in the Scopes monkey trial. In fact, every line of evidence they used in the Scopes monkey trial in 1912 is now acknowledged by evolutionists that every one of them was wrong and no longer accepted. Yet that trial caused many Christians to say, we can't believe Genesis anymore. We've got to believe in theistic evolution, if anything. And they believe the words of man over the words of God. The Bible says, let God be true and every man a liar. And in this case, we've seen they're all liars. Now, how do we replace Piltdown Man? They came out with Boxgrove Man. Well, they have a lot of fossil evidence, as you can see. But remember what I said? Don't look at the drawing. Ask to see the actual bone evidence. In this case, it must be very impressive because they know exactly what he looked like, but all they really found was this one shin bone that was pretty much indistinguishable from a modern human shin bone. You know, how in the world they know he looked like this? You know, imagine if you died a few centuries ago and you got buried and everything rotted away except for your shin, and then somebody digs it up and says, oh, I know what that guy looked like. He looked like this. You might think there's a little prejudice in how they reconstruct things. Here we have Eosimius, which means the Dawn Simian, one of our early ancestors from the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. They must have a lot of evidence for this, right? I mean, look at this detailed picture. Got to have tons of fossil evidence. Ask the question, how much? Well, how much is this? A couple of jaw fragments, and how big are they? The size of grains of rice. And yet, what did they say from this evidence, as if they're divining tea leaves and have some kind of clairvoyant powers? They said this shows it was shy, nocturnal, and had large saucer-like eyes and flitted about the treetops. Well, it sounds like they were an eyewitness, and all they got is a couple of grain of rice-sized pieces of jawbone. So if you don't ask to say, I want to see the fossils for myself, you can buy into beautiful pictures like this and think, man, they got a lot of evidence, when in fact they have nothing of any significance whatsoever. Ardipithecus rhamnosus Gadaba, what a mouthful. Ardipithecus is an Ethiopian word, it's found in Ethiopia, meaning root of the ground ape. In other words, when monkeys and apes started coming down out of trees onto the ground, this is one of the first ones to do that. And it's based, again, on fragmentary evidence. Now, here we have six toe bones. How many toe bones did they find? One. Well, they took that one toe bone and photographed it from three different angles and drew it from three different angles. So if you don't read the fine print, you might think they had six when they only had one. Furthermore, that's the only evidence of it being a hominid or an ape man. State is claimed on the basis of a single bone, and this bone is very long and curved, typical of tree-dwelling apes. Those long, curved fingers help them grab onto tree limbs, okay? It's not like human toe bones at all. Nonetheless, this was found 18 kilometers away in a different rock layer or stratum from the rest of these bones. Well, by clairvoyance, I guess they know these other bones belong to this thing, even though it was found 18 kilometers away. Where was everything else found? Spread over an area 15 kilometers long, which has prompted some people to ask the question, was this history's first suicide bomber? And indeed, was he carrying a nuclear bomb when it went off, since it blasted his fragments for kilometers all over the place? Well, so much for Ardipithecus rhamnosus Gadaba. Now, and like what Nigel Hawkes says, that's actually a typo there, it's not Locks, it's Hawkes, in the Times London, he said, few sciences produced such abundant returns from so few fragments of fact as paleontology, which means the study of fossils. Now, in Science magazine, published by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, they have an early Ardipithecus rhamnosus candidate. They looked at the fragments of the skull, and they correctly adduced is nothing but an ape skull. But they wanted it to be an early ancestor of man, so it had to be part man and part ape. Well, it sure doesn't look like it. It looks like one of the most primitive apes, almost a monkey-like ape, instead of a human-like ape. It's a monkey-like ape. It's going in reverse, you might say. Well, did anybody notice anything unusual about the hand of Ardipithecus? Anything unusual about that hand? Well, none of you have challenged that that's a hand. That is not a hand. That is its foot. It had feet that looked like hands. What does that tell you about whether or not it walked upright like a human? Try walking on your hands, see how comfortable it is. They're not designed to walk like feet. Now, chimpanzees have long curved toes and a long prehensile big toe that acts like a thumb to help it grab tree limbs, so it can climb up trees pretty easily, but this thing looks almost completely like a hand. In other words, it spent almost all of its time grabbing tree limbs and living in the trees and not walking on the ground. That's obvious from its anatomy. However, when they reconstruct the thing, how do they know it looked like this? I mean, right off, you can see it's disproportionate. Notice we have the lower leg bones here. Notice how short they are? You notice they're longer here. I guess we're supposed to be born yesterday and so dumb we don't notice it's disproportionately drawn. Well, for crying out loud, we weren't born yesterday, and this reconstruction that was done for this TV special on it shows that they're trying to give it more human-like proportions to give the illusion that it's part ape and part man. I'll never forget, the reporter was asking the man doing this reconstruction, he did a model of it as well as the drawings, and he says, you know, the vertebrae, the rib cage, the shoulders, shoulder sockets, all of that's missing. Most of the pelvis is missing. How do you know that these missing parts look like this? And he said something very interesting. He said, well, we know what human anatomy looks like, and we know what ape anatomy looks like, and so I've made it look intermediate between the two. Really? But then they put this picture in a textbook and say, there's your proof of an ape man because it's half man and half ape. And the guy who did it says he purposely made it look that way, even though the evidence is completely missing. That's not proof. That's prejudice. That's, you know, we want you to believe this, so we're going to make a fairy tale and do a cartoon, and you can believe with us in our nice little fairy tale. But it has nothing to do with concrete science. And, of course, these feet are not designed to walk. They're designed for grabbing limbs in trees. Now, in the flesh reconstruction, we see also this prejudice. Notice the whites in the eyes. There are no apes living today that have whites in their eyes. Their eyes are completely dark, no whites. Remember the famous cry at Bunker Hill against the British that said, don't shoot till you see the whites of their eyes. In other words, until they're pretty close. Well, if apes were coming after you, you'd never shoot because you never see the whites of their eyes. They don't have any, okay? But notice he put whites in this creature's eyes, even though we don't have any eyes preserved in the fossil record. How does he know it had whites in its eyes? It's to make it look half human and half ape. We don't see it here, but it gave it human-like breasts. It's supposed to be a female. Well, human breasts and ape breasts are quite different, and that's not preserved in the fossil record. How in the world would he know what it looks like? But by making these subtle changes, it kind of psychologically has an impact. Well, it does seem to look somewhat human. Well, everybody admits that the skull is completely ape-like, and most of the skeleton isn't even there. They can't make any scientific assessment of that evidence which does not exist. Now, William Youngers, who is an evolutionist anatomist, he called him on this. He said, this is a fascinating skeleton, but based on what they present, the evidence for bipedality, meaning walking upright in two legs in a human fashion, is limited at best. Divergent big toes are associated with grasping. And this has one of the most divergent big toes you can imagine. As you saw, it looks like a hand and not a foot. Why would an animal fully adapted to support its weight on its forelimbs in the trees elect to walk bipedally on the ground, especially since it doesn't have ground-walking anatomy? It has tree-dwelling anatomy. Now, Dr. Tim White, notable evolutionist anthropologist, he points out what the real problem is. Even though he's an evolutionist, he pours scorn on his fellow evolutionist anthropologists. He said, a 5-million-year-old piece of bone that was thought to be the collarbone of a human-like creature is actually part of a dolphin rib. The problem with a lot of anthropologists is that they want so much to find a hominid, which means an ape man, that any scrap of bone becomes a hominid bone. Because you want to publish or perish. You want to get your name in the papers. You want to get research grants. You want to have fame and fortune. You don't get that by finding, you know, non-ape men. Now, finding apes is insignificant, because their own theory says that all the apes are on side branches that are going in their own trajectory and never led to human beings. They need something on the same branch that led to humans that would be half human and half ape. But if it's completely an ape, their own theory says it's not evidence for evolution because they never led to humans. They're on their own trajectory on a different branch. So you got to have half man, half ape hominid, and they're willing to take dolphin rib bones, just about anything else they can lay their hands on, to get their name in the paper. We can document from history that ape men have been deduced from bones which actually belong to an alligator, a horse, a bear, an elephant, a donkey, and as we just saw, a dolphin. And that's just a partial list. Here we have How Man Evolved on the cover of Time magazine. Notice much of the most crucial anatomy of the skull, which would determine whether or not it's an ape man or not, is missing. They filled it in with clay or wax or something. But how do they know what this missing evidence looked like? Well, of course, like the other guy said, well, we want to make it look halfway between an ape and a man. Well, if they'd admit that in the textbooks, that would at least be truth in advertising. But just saying this is the way it looked by expert reconstruction is not telling the whole story. Nobody knows what it really looked like. There's not enough evidence there to deduce it. Here we have the famous missing link Iceman. Now, this is supposed to have been the holy grail of ape men. It's not just some bones. This guy supposedly fell off a cliff into a glacier and got deep frozen, you know, tens of thousands, if not 100,000 or more years ago. And serendipity happened, and he got found, and the guy who found it kept him refrigerated in a block of ice. And instead of going to the Smithsonian and saying, hey, I've got not just some bones, I have the whole flesh, the skin, the hair, the DNA, an entire ape man preserved deep frozen. If you want it, make sure you spell my name right on the check. I want $2 million. And they'd say, how do you spell your name? Okay, if he said $2 billion, they'd probably say, how do you spell your name? Because this is what they would love to have. Now, instead of going to the Smithsonian, he put this on the circuit sideshow tour. What does that tell you about how much confidence he had in it? And when people like the Smithsonian heard about it, they sent one of their experts and said, we'd like to do a little analysis. Could we drill in and take a biopsy of the tissue? Could we use it, do x-rays? The guy said, no way, Jose. You don't do any forensic analysis. You can photograph it in the block of ice. That's it. Now, that should have been a big red flag that he didn't have anything legitimate. But Bernard Heuvelmans, a famous Belgian zoologist, he looked at it and said, by golly, it looks like a sub-Neanderthaloid ape man to me. And he wrote up an article about how this was a marvelous proof of evolution. But it wasn't. What it actually was not an ape man, but just a rubber dummy frozen in a block of ice. This guy had gone down to Hollywood where they can make out of latex any kind of monster you want for the movies. And he said, make me one that looks like an ape man. Then he covered it externally with bear's fur and kept it refrigerated in a block of ice and paraded it as the missing link. And you have people like Bernard Heuvelmans, international famous scientist, saying, hey, it's proof of evolution, when it was nothing but a fraud, which goes to show that just because you have a PhD doesn't make you immune to the human frailties of pride, prejudice, and preconceived ideas. It fit the preconceived idea. It didn't have any legitimate evidence at all. We'll skip that. 21st century fraud. A leading Japanese archaeologist, whom colleagues had nicknamed God's Hands for his uncanny ability to know just where to dig to find ancient relics, has publicly admitted to faking his most recent discoveries. Shinichi Fujimura was renowned for discovering Japan's oldest sites of civilization, making front page news each time he found ever older artifacts. But a Japanese newspaper had secretly photographed Fujimura sneaking onto the site in the early morning, digging holes and burying the stone implements a few days before he and colleagues unearthed them and proudly announced the quote-unquote discovery to the media. After exposure, Fujimura apologized to the media, head bowed, saying, I can't imagine what made me do it. Well, I can. He was getting fame and fortune, and he wanted more. You know, it's like Rockefeller. They once asked him, well, how much is it going to be enough when you finally have enough? And he says, just a bit more, just a bit more. And he wanted more fame and more fortune, and he was willing to lie and cheat and, you know, commit fraud to do it. The only difference is he got caught. How many times has this happened? When it comes to evolution, they don't look at it, look the gift horse in the mouth. They want all the evidence they can get because they really have so little. Now, here we have a problem. Often we find just a fragment of jaw, this darkened fragment here. It's the same in both of these. How do you reconstruct it? If you reconstruct it like this, with a U-shaped jaw, large canine teeth, a diastema gap here that allows the top canine teeth to fit in that gap, big long incisor teeth, it's nothing but an ape or a baboon. Remember, finding an ape is worthless. They're not even on a branch that led to humans, according to their own theory. So that's worthless, but if you take that same jaw fragment, you make the jaw form more parabolic, reminiscent of man. You reduce the size of the canines and the incisor, and you get rid of the diastema gap altogether. Well, you could call up and say, I found an ape man. You get your name in the papers. You might get a contract with National Geographic. You'll get on the Discovery Channel. You get fame and fortune for taking the very same bone fragment and reconstructing it differently. It's the same fragment in both cases. Can anybody guess which one they would prefer to reconstruct? Because if you do it this way, you get a lot out of it. If you do it this way, you get nothing. So as evolutionist Jay Shreve says, everybody knows fossils are fickle. Bones will sing any song you want to hear, but they're never allowed to sing the song of creation, which they can sing the best for sure. Now here we have the skull that made Louis B. Leakey famous back in late 50s, early 60s, his Xinj Anthropus man, or East Africa man. It was taken to four different experts who drew what it looked like in the flesh. Notice all the experts disagreed, even though they were drawing from the same skull. This one looks rather like an ape with an ape-like nose, and this one has more of a human nose and a beard and the eyes of a philosopher. He's deep in thought. Boy, he's well on his way to being human. Yeah, they're all drawn from the same skull, for crying out loud. So just whose opinion do we believe in? Furthermore, the real amazing irony of history is that nobody today accepts this skull as having any significance in human evolution. They said it's nothing but an extinct ape on a side branch that went extinct and never led to human beings. Now, nobody knows that better than this fellow here, illustrator Ronald J. Irvin. He is actually a born-again Christian, but he's an excellent artist, and therefore he's been hired for many years doing anatomical drawings for books of anatomy and biology. Well, under contract, he was supposed to draw a picture of what Australopithecus afarensis, or Lucy, as it's called. That's because when Donald Johanson's team found it in Africa, the Beatles song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was playing on the tape player. So they nicknamed her Lucy. But her actual technical name is Australopithecus afarensis, from the Afar region of Ethiopia and Africa. So they said, look at the fossil evidence and draw this ape woman, because we have to have an illustration for our textbook. And he said, well, there's not much there to work with, but I'll go ahead and do it. And so he drew this picture, and he was immediately regaled and castigated. They said, for crying out loud, don't you know she's supposed to be an ape woman? You have made her look way too human. Why, she looks like some angry, homely woman we've all seen walking down the street now and then. You need to go back and make her look more like an ape woman. And so they basically was telling him, draw what we want you to draw and forget about the physical evidence. That doesn't make any difference, as long as you put on the textbook what we want to see. So he blew the whistle on them and said, you know, I'm quit. You can't fire me. I quit. And he blew the whistle and he said, I know firsthand that you should not trust these illustrations in our textbooks, because they don't care about what the physical evidence shows. They just want it to support evolution. We have a page from the book by Richard Leakey, the son of the famous Richard Leakey, and he shows that an insect-eating mammal, an insectivore, was supposedly the prime progenitor of the tarsiers, lorisers, lemurs, the new and old world monkeys, the great apes, and even the line that led to modern man. But none of these branches exist in the fossil record. Remember what Stephen Gould said about the tree? Branches don't connect. But they assume evolution is true, and even though there's no concrete fossil evidence for any of these branches, they draw the branches in the textbook because they're sure evolution must be true. Therefore, it's justified, since they just know somehow, by clairvoyance or something, that evolution must be true, they draw the branches there. But notice, we have here the lemurs, okay? The lemurs aren't very closely related to man. They're way up there on the tree. But not that many years ago, they found a lemur, a fossil, perhaps the most beautiful, complete fossil of a lemur that's ever been found. But that's all it is. And it's not anywhere close to human evolution. Nonetheless, they had this massive media campaign where they said this find will be as memorable in history and as unforgettable as Pearl Harbor, as unforgettable as the assassination of John F. Kennedy, as unforgettable as the first man on the moon. Do any of you remember it, by the way, Ida? Didn't turn out to be so memorable, did it? Well, really, it was mainly pushing the sale of this book, and they had a TV special on it as well, and really all they have is this living creature today called a lemur. You can go to a zoo, any kind of a decent zoo will have lemurs that you can look at. They're living today. They're not anywhere close to humans, even on the evolutionary theory. Yet they took this fossil of a living creature and tried to say, here's the missing link, here's proof of evolution. Even the evolutionists called them out on this. Chris Beard, a paleontologist at the Carnegie Museum, he is an evolutionist. He said, it's not a missing link. It's not even a terribly close relative to monkeys and apes and humans, which is the point they're trying to make. Also, we find that Matt Cartmill, an evolutionist anthropologist at Duke University, North Carolina, he said the PR, or public relations campaign, on this fossil is, I think, more of a story than the fossil itself. It's a very beautiful fossil, but I don't see anything in this paper that told me anything decisive that was new. What new is there to say about something that's the same as what's living today, a lemur? Richard Kay, evolutionist at Duke University, he said Ida's unveiling was highly scripted with some Barnum and Bailey aspects. You know, Barnum and Bailey's circus, well, I think it was P.T. Barnum that said, what, there's a sucker born every day or something like that? Maybe he didn't, they just described it to him. But anyway, he is an evolutionist paleontologist, and he said, more important, it can now be said the findings may well have been significantly overstated, but if this event causes the public to distrust science and the media, that distrust is well placed. Oh, what a rare gem. You rarely get these kind of admissions in the secular media. But this guy called him out and said this is just a bunch of smoke and mirrors showmanship and nothing scientific about it at all. And when you get these overstated stories in the media, don't believe it, because they're willing to deceive you and lie to you. Now, the line that supposedly led to man started with the alleged common ancestor of apes and men. Remember, we don't evolve directly from apes, but apes and man evolved in parallel. People say, if we evolved, why are there still apes? Because their theory says that there was a common ancestor of apes and man, one branched in the line that led to man, and one branched off into the great apes. So we evolved in parallel. That's why there's still apes today. So saying, why are there apes today, is not a good reputation based on what their own theory says. But what they need is, you know, clear fossil transitions on the line that supposedly led to man, that's clearly part ape and part man. Now, the Hamididai line that supposedly started it, nobody can agree on what creature is the common ancestor of ape and man to this day. So it's really up for grabs, and there's no real clear concrete evidence. That supposedly started about 30 million years ago. Then it went through, evolved through Rhomopithecus, Australopithecus, Homo erectus, finally Homo sapiens. Now, pithecus in Greek means ape. So Rhomopithecus means the ape of Rama, found near Rama, India. Australopithecus is a compound Latin and Greek word. Austral means southern, like Australia is the southern continent. Pithecus, again, in Greek means ape, so the name actually means southern ape. When it was first found in southern Africa by Dr. Raymond Dart, he gave it the appropriate name, southern ape, not southern hominid, not southern ape man, because he felt, as everybody else did back in the 20s, we're going to find something much better. Well, time went on, they didn't find anything better, so they go back to the southern ape, and all of a sudden it's half human because they need it to be, not because they found anything better. Homo erectus means erect man. As we shall see, he lives up to his name. He was human like you and I, descended from Adam just like us. Homo sapiens means man the wise, although you wonder how wise he is when he thinks he evolved from apes. And that includes Neanderthal man, Cro-Magnon, and modern man. So let's start with Rhomopithecus here. That's all we had for many years. A couple of jaw fragments. You always ask how much they have. David Pilbeam and Elwin Simons, major American evolutionists, they said, you know, it's embarrassing that we don't have an early ancestor. We don't have the common ancestor, and we don't have an early ancestor. That's embarrassing. What are we going to say when the creationists challenge us? So this is good enough. Let's use this to reconstruct in the textbooks the early ancestor, Rhomopithecus. So they went from this to this. Ta-da, there it is. You know, isn't it nice that they can make models based on a couple of jaw fragments? But what happened again is so classic. It's happened over and over and over again. Just like Piltdown Man, just like Nebraska Man, they make these grandiose claims on fragmentary evidence, then they find more complete evidence. This happened with Kenyapithecus and others that they claimed were ape men. Well, guess what? We have this more complete skull evidence of Rhomopithecus. Now, we compare it here with the skull of an orangutan and the skull of a chimpanzee over here. Now, notice that the shape of the face here does not correspond with the chimp, but it sure does with the orangutan. Much the same shape. This ridge above the eye socket called the orbital ridge looks practically identical. This extension on the side of the skull called the mastoid process looks virtually identical. The tooth and jaw morphology or shape is practically identical. This caused David Pilbeam and Elwin Simons to say, boy, we're sorry. We found nothing but an extinct orangutan, which nobody believes we evolved directly from. It's an ape on its own branch going the wrong trajectory, and therefore there's no proof that Rhomopithecus was an early ancestor. So we start with no common ancestor that they can find or agree on. The early ancestor turns out to be just an orangutan and therefore not involved in human evolution by their own theory. We go for supposedly millions of years of evolution with nothing until we come to the Australopithecines, the southern apes, which they make a big whoop-de-doo about. Here we have Australopithecus robustus. If you know anything about anatomy, this is a classic in every single detail, nothing but an ape. It has a massive ape-like jaw, ape-like teeth, big mastoid processes like apes have on the side, very low-vaulted face, very low-vaulted forehead, practically no forehead at all, big orbital ridges above the eye sockets, a sagittal crest, a bony ridge that runs longitudinally along the skull that you have jaw muscles attached to as an anchor because they have powerful jaws and they need an anchor for those muscles. Look how big those jaws and teeth are, for crying out loud. Because of this, all the evolutionists admit, from the neck up, all of the Australopithecines are nothing but apes. So they say they evolved with their body into man first, and only later did their skull and their brain evolve into man. It's supposed to be man's brain power that gave him the advantage. Yet supposedly the relatively frail human body evolved first instead of his brain. Why do they do that? Because they're forced to. Everybody can see it's nothing but the skull of an ape. Now, here we have it compared with the skull of a gorilla, and we can see again that it is very grossly ape-like. I'm not the only one to notice. Here we have Ashley Montague, who is an outstanding evolutionist anthropologist, one of the greatest of the 20th century. He said the skull form of all Australopithecines is extremely ape-like. The Australopithecines show too many specialized and ape-like characteristics to be either the direct ancestor of man or of the line that led to man. But he's not quoted in our textbooks because he's an evolutionist who's speaking the truth. He's being honest about it. Also, Lord Solly Zuckerman. Zuckerman was an atheist, and he was knighted by the Queen of England as Sir Solly Zuckerman because of his scientific achievements. He studied the Australopithecines with a top research team in Great Britain for more than 15 years. Although a dyed-in-the-world atheist evolutionist, he honestly concluded, I myself remain totally unpersuaded. Almost always when I've tried to check the anatomical claims on which the status of Australopithecus is based, I have ended in failure. The Australopithecine skull is in fact so overwhelmingly simian, meaning ape-like, as opposed to human, that the contrary proposition could be equated to an assertion that black is white. Is that obvious? This is nothing but an extinct ape, which means if they were living today, they've gone extinct, but animals going extinct is not evolution, it just means they died out. But if it were living today, since all of its anatomical features are diagnostically nothing but ape, it'd be put in the zoo with the other three living great apes as a fourth great ape. But it certainly wouldn't be called an ape man if we could see it living today. Now, here we have the fossil remains of Lucy, Australopithecus afarensis, and they have often claimed they have 40% of the postcranial skeleton, the skeleton below the skull. Actually, they only have closer to 20%. When we asked them, why do you keep saying 40% when there's not that much? They say, well, nobody hardly ever finds foot bones, and there's a lot of bones in the foot, so we just don't count those. Well, why don't you tell the students the truth? If you don't count all the foot bones, then you have 40%, but in reality, you only have about 20%. Even at that, what they have looks very ape-like, especially the pelvis. In apes, the pelvis is flared outward like this, whereas in humans, it tends to curve inward. And this pelvis does not support human mobility, walking upright on two legs in a human fashion. And this bothered Donald Johanson, the famous finder of Lucy. So he said, with that anatomy, she could not have walked upright. But he says, I think I know what happened. A deer stepped on that pelvis and deformed it. And so it doesn't look the way it should. You know, as if he saw that, that's not scientific. He didn't see anything. He's just coming up with a theory. So he made an exact cast replica of it, sent it to his fellow evolutionist, Owen Lovejoy, and on a special first aired by the BBC in Australia and New Zealand, it showed his colleague, Owen Lovejoy, cutting this thing into pieces with a power saw and then gluing it back together to look human-like. Then he put it back together and say, see, now she walks upright just like a human. See, he has claimed that although she was only about 4.5 feet tall, her postcranial skeleton was like a modern human. She could walk and run every bit as good as a modern human. Only later did her skull evolve into a human skull. Well, apparently she's not so human as they claim. Now, the skull of Lucy's type of ape is grossly ape-like in every way. She only had a brain about the size of a baseball, okay? Only about 4.5 feet tall and grossly ape-like, not even remotely human-like at all. Nonetheless, when we look at the bottom of the skull, we can make some interesting comparisons. We see this hole here on the bottom of the skull. In humans, it's located toward the center. That's called the foramen magnum, where the spinal column attaches to the skull. And for erect posture, you have to have the attachment near the center of the skull, as it is here. Apes tend to stoop over and knuckle walk on all four limbs rather than walk upright. They rarely walk upright. When they do, they're very non-human in their gait because they don't have the anatomy to walk like a human, and it's not comfortable for them. That's why they don't do it very often. But part of the problem is this: the spinal column is attached toward the rear of the skull, and that gives them a bent-over posture by nature. Notice Lucy here in the center, her foramen magnum is even closer to the rear of her skull than a living ape, the chimpanzee today. For that reason alone, it would have a more ape-like posture. Okay, so chimp, Lucy, and human. Also, when we look at the shoulder blades, shoulder socket, in humans, it's large and it's designed so that your arms could swing in parallel when you're running or walking to keep your balance. However, in apes, it's quite different in its configuration. It's designed more for constantly reaching up, grabbing tree limbs. And so it doesn't look human at all. They said it would look just like human, but when we finally found it, it looks just like apes, not like humans, even though he claimed that below the skull, it was every bit as much a human skeleton as you and I have. Here we have the comparison of the gorilla, Lucy, and human. Notice the ear hole on apes is much larger than the ear hole on humans, but it's what's on the inside that counts. On the inside, you have the semicircular canal system of the balance mechanism of the inner ear. In humans, this is very large because we have to balance on two legs and run and walk and keep our balance. That requires a better, bigger balance mechanism. Apes, like gorillas and Lucy, if they're in the trees, they use all four limbs because their feet can grab tree limbs just as good as a hand because their big toes and their long toes act like a hand. They're more like a hand in grabbing limbs. So they use all four appendages when they get down on the ground. They lock their wrists, they have locking wrists, and they knuckle walk on all fours. Rarely do they stand up and try to walk on two legs. It's just hard for them to do it. So if what they said is true about Lucy, that she could walk and run as well as a modern human, then she must have had a human-like inner ear semicircular canal balance mechanism. Instead, it's not halfway between humans and apes, and it's not human, it's completely ape-like. For that reason alone, the MRI scans and CAT scans, everything like that, have shown it's nothing but an ape, and it could not possibly have walked upright like humans any more than any other ape because it didn't have the balance mechanism to do so. Now, I quote here Dr. Charles Oxnard, former professor of anatomy and anthropology at the University of Chicago, then at USC for a while. He's currently at the University of Western Australia. And he pioneered computer multivariate analysis, where they take bones and they rotate them 360 degrees, very sophisticated now. They scan them with lasers and get precise measurements mathematically of their size and shape and morphology. All this mathematical data is fed in the computer. So they take like the pelvis of monkeys, great apes, Lucy, man, rotate them 360 degrees, scan them, get precise mathematical measurements. Then the computer compares them back and forth. How close or how dissimilar are they? Every time that's been done, he said that the computer showed decisively that this was nothing but an ape, not an ape man, but just a fourth ape that has gone extinct. Now, he's the recognized expert in the field, the pioneer in his field, and he's an evolutionist. So he's not saying this because he wants to help the creationists. He's just saying it because it's true. So he said the Australopithecines known over the last several decades are now irrevocably removed from a place in the evolution of human bipedalism, possibly from a place in a group any closer to humans than the African apes, and certainly from any place in the direct human lineage, based on actual physical data, not anybody's opinion. Well, they never quote him in our textbooks, do they? Because if the students saw this, they would not be impressed with evidence for human evolution. Now, the depiction of Lucy in the Chicago Field Museum of Natural History is very, very deceptive. In fact, one of our creationist anatomists challenged them and said, why do you show that depiction when we have found all these missing parts and we know that it doesn't look like this? See, at first, they didn't have that much of the postcranial skeleton. They didn't have the hands. They didn't have the ankle and the feet. They didn't have the rib cage. Well, in apes, the rib cage is more conical shape. It's not barrel shaped like it is in humans. When they found a rib cage, guess what? It was conical. It was ape-like. Everybody admits that the skull is ape-like, and they did that correctly, but notice they put whites in her eyes, didn't they? Again, to give that impression that it's partly human. But they said that her hands should have looked just like human hands. Well, we found those hands that looked like meat hooks, big, long, curved, ape-like fingers, but they didn't change the depiction. So she had long curved fingers, which they don't show. We have found that now. She had locking wrists. If she could walk and run as good as a modern human, why does she still have locking wrists where they lock the wrists and walk on their knuckles? Why do you have knuckle walking anatomy still if you've already evolved the ability to walk and run as good as a modern human? She had the wrong talus angle where the lower bones of the leg connect with the ankle. It was the right angle for climbing up trees frequently, but not walking upright in a fully human manner. And we finally found her foot. This looks like a hairy human foot. Other than being hairy, it is indistinguishable from a modern human foot. When they actually found the fossil foot, what did it look like? Distinctly ape-like, like a chimpanzee, not human-like at all. So all these areas where they predicted that when they found this, it would confirm that her body was just like a modern human below the skull, everything failed. But did they change the depiction? No. When he said, why not? They said, oh, we don't want to burden the taxpayers. You know, it'll cost so much money. Well, you know, is it better to take our tax money and misrepresent the truth and lie to us? You know, I mean, tax money well spent is when people actually get to hear the truth. But that was their excuse. They didn't want to change it. Why? Because if they did, everybody would see, well, that's nothing but an ape. That's no proof of an ape man, for crying out loud. Now, here we have the partial skull of Lucy, and National Geographic did the flesh reconstruction, their artist. Notice, big whites in the eyes. You don't find that in the fossil record. Only humans have whites like that. But he admitted fully his prejudice, at least. He said, I wanted to get a human soul into this ape-like face to indicate something about where she was headed. Well, looking at a dead skull with no eyes in it, you don't know where she's headed. That's just a belief in evolution. But putting it like that to deceive people is not legitimate science. Now, Homo habilis, meaning handyman, made Louis B. Leakey famous, but they've realized now it's a mixture of ape and human fossils, two different types of creatures. Now, that's not a legitimate way to get an ape man, but they throw some ape parts and human parts into the bin and they come out with Homo habilis. Well, because of that, they realize now that it is an invalid taxon, a mixture of more than one fossil type, but have they gotten rid of the pictures and the designation in the textbook? No. Why? When evolutionists were very honest, he said, if there weren't a homo habilis, we would have to invent one. So even though the one we have is illegitimate, we're going to keep it in there, because otherwise we just have to replace it with another illegitimate one, so we'll just keep it there. American Journal of Physical Anthropology admitted that. Now, because they failed so miserably to find credible evidence in the fossil record, they've turned a lot to genetics in modern times and molecular biology. In the museum in Melbourne, Australia, on the display on the origin of man, they said, too close for comfort, question mark. Believe it or not, our DNA is nearly identical to a chimpanzee's. Less than 2% of our DNA differs from theirs. These tiny differences in DNA have caused large differences in appearance and behavior, but our DNA reminds us of how closely related we really are. Really. Well, for a long time, they said it's less than 2%. In more recent years, they've said it's only about 1%. And that's been in the textbooks for a long time. And that's one of their major arguments. Well, evolution has to be true. There's only 1% difference between us and apes. Really? Doesn't make a lot of sense, because I don't see any apes building skyscrapers and space shuttles and supercomputers and the internet. You know, they could learn something from Al Gore, who made the internet, you know. Our ape brethren don't seem to be quite up to speed, and it's because there is a big difference between us and apes. Now, a recent report in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences suggests that the similarity of DNA between chimps and humans is 95% rather than greater than 98%. In other words, a full 5% difference just on one category. These are indels, insertion and deletion nucleotides, which are like the alphabet letters of DNA. 5% difference right there is a lot more than they've ever said, but as we've investigated more with the Human Genome Project, we now have completely elucidated the chimpanzee genome and the human genome. In the old studies, they deliberately cherry-picked. They took strands of DNA from humans and chimpanzees, and ones that looked dissimilar, they threw out of the study. And only the ones that looked rather similar, they kept. And that's where they got that 1% difference. They cherry-picked it. It was a flawed, prejudiced study. Never got into any textbook. But when you're desperate, desperate men will do desperate things. But now that we've had more time and have much better knowledge of the genome of humans and chimpanzees, we found that for years, chimpanzees were considered to be only 1% genetically dissimilar to humans. A recent gene splicing study revealed a 6 to 8% difference. A 2003 study revealed a 13% difference in our respective immune systems. And another study revealed a 17% difference in gene expression in our cerebral cortexes. Better genetic technology and increasing knowledge of the critical function of non-coding regions, formerly referred to as junk DNA. So a lot of it's just junk. Well, it turns out now that more than 80% of it isn't junk. And the more research we're doing, probably close to 100% is going to appear not be junk, but have purposeful meaning, which they can't explain. There should be a lot of junk DNA if evolution is true. But they didn't even look at this because they said, well, it's just junk. It has no purpose. Well, it's in these non-coding sections that are important in regulatory functions and are necessary. It's in there they found some of the biggest differences that they never even bothered to look at before. That means on the average, although it's up to 17% in some places, on the average, it's a good 15% different, about 15 times worse than what they claimed. That adds up to a lot of information, by the way. There's 3 billion nucleotides, or alphabet letters, genetic alphabet letters in the human genome. You take 15% of that, if you put it into books that had a billion bytes of information per book, it would only produce about 450 of those books of information different between us and chimpanzees. They can't even get one paragraph or one large sentence in trillions of years by chance. That's a mathematical fact. How are they going to bridge that huge gap of 450 large books of information that's different in a mere 6 million years? They said, well, 6 million years, we can account for 1%, which really is not even true. But when it's 15% and only 6 million years, they're in big trouble. They cannot explain how that could have been produced, even by their best theories. But it gets worse. Dr. David Page at the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research, regarding the human and chimp Y chromosome. Dr. Page admitted that the Y chromosomes of chimps and humans are, quote, horrendously different from each other, which is not supposed to be the case if there's only 1% in our general genetics. Why in the world would the Y chromosome be so different? And it's not just a little different. It's much worse than the rest of the genetic package. Dr. Page's team found that the chimp Y chromosome has only 2/3 as many distinct genes or gene families as the human Y chromosome, and only 47% as many protein coding elements as humans. Furthermore, more than 30% of the chimp Y chromosome lacks any alignable counterpart with the human Y chromosome. For creatures that are only separated by a mere 6 million years, just practically a heartbeat in the evolutionary timescale, these huge differences should not exist. But now we know they do. We are not closely related to apes. When anybody quotes you that, oh, there's only 1% difference, I say, why don't you come into the new millennium? That was believed back in the old millennium when we didn't know hardly anything based on a flawed study. Now that we have elucidated the complete human and chimpanzee genome, we see huge differences that cannot be explained by evolution, as you would expect, because we're not made in the image of apes. We're made in the image of God and descended from Adam. Now, Dr. Page, also at the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research, Dr. Page admitted that the Y chromosomes of chimps and humans are, quote, horrendously different from each other. Well, we've already quoted that. Let me get the second one up here. Dr. Page now admits that the percentage relationship between human and chimp Y chromosomes has been blown to pieces. They used to say it was predicted to be very close. Now that they've examined it, it's hugely different, hugely different. And, you know, this is something that was totally unexpected. They did not predict it, and I don't know what they're going to do with it. They're going to say somehow rapid evolution did it, but that's just basically waving a magic wand and saying abracadabra, we want it to be true, so it is. Scientifically, it cannot be explained, but it's exactly what you'd predict on the basis of biblical creation. Here we have Homo erectus, which means erect man. They make him look rather dirty and brutish and dim-witted and subhuman, but he was as human as you and I. The Turkana boy, he averaged 5'10". Actually, Turkana boy was over 6 feet tall, but the Homo erectus averaged 5'10". You know what the global average of adult humans is globally today? It's 5'9". So these people averaged taller than the average we have today. Their skeleton is so indistinguishable from a modern human skeleton that you really can't tell any difference unless you're an expert in anatomy, and it's no more than the minor differences we have in living populations of humans today between different ethnic varieties of human beings. It's no big difference at all. The only big difference, they don't have an ape-like skull, they have a human skull, but it's smaller on the average than what we have today. Well, Neanderthals are bigger on the average than what we have today. Some have bigger heads, some have smaller heads. But the importance is that it's a lot bigger than any apes, and it's well within the human range for normal human IQ and intelligence. They found one individual that had just a 700 cubic centimeter cranial capacity, okay, about half normal, and he had normal IQ. It's not the sheer size of the brain that imparts intelligence, but it's the organization of the brain. That's why birds, like crows and ravens and the African gray parrot, on certain cognitive tests, they outscored chimpanzees. Yet chimpanzees have a much larger brain than crows and African gray parrots. So it's the organization of the brain is most important. Now, the average for humans today is about 1,400 cubic centimeters. Some people have up to 2,200. It's about the largest we've ever seen, but they don't have that much, they don't have any larger IQ. They have the same average IQ. So brain size itself does not equate with intelligence. You can have it small and have normal IQ. You can have it big and have normal IQ. But Homo erectus averaged 900 to 1,000 cubic centimeters, placing them well within the known range of normal human IQ. Anatomically, they were human. Furthermore, we have evidence that they intermarried with Cro-Magnon-type people in Europe, which are the same as modern Europeans today. In other words, if you can intermarry and have fertile offspring, that is the primary definition of the same human species. Now, here we have the early depictions of Neanderthal man. Poor guy got the bad rap from the beginning. His name was taken from the Neander Valley near Dusseldorf, Germany, where he was first found in 1856, and was old arthritic man suffering from bone degenerative disease. So no wonder he's bent over in an ape-like posture. He had bone-deforming disease. But they used that to justify depicting him like this. So Neanderthal is how it is pronounced. It's the Neander Valley, and Tall, T-H-A-L in German, means valley. So early depictions, very grossly ape-like, but their actual full anatomy, we found plenty of complete skeletons of Neanderthal, they're fully human, and they were very robust. They looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger without even having to work out. They're much stronger than us on the average, and their cranial capacity was larger than modern humans on the average. That doesn't really prove anything, but it goes to show they had big brains and big, strong bodies and human anatomy. Well, the more modern depictions of them in the American Museum of Natural History look like people we've all seen walking down the street now and then. You know, give them a shaved bath haircut, put them in a business suit, people wouldn't pay much attention to it. In some circles, you wouldn't even have to give them a shaved bath and a haircut, and they'd still get along just fine. Okay, little joke there. Okay, Eric Trinkus, who is perhaps the world's most renowned expert in Neanderthals, and he is not a Christian, he is an evolutionist. He said, detailed comparison of Neanderthal skeletal remains with those of modern humans have shown that there is nothing in Neanderthal anatomy that conclusively indicates locomotor, manipulative, intellectual, or linguistic abilities inferior to those of modern humans. We find evidence that they did beautiful artistry. They made musical instruments like flutes. They had the command of fire. They made jewelry, which is unique to humans. Okay? Not only that, much to the chagrin of the evolutionists who for many, many decades claimed that these were ape-like ancestors of ours, we now find Neanderthal genes in the human genome. And if you're of European ancestry, you likely have Neanderthal genes in your genome. In other words, they intermarried with modern Europeans, what we would call Cro-Magnon type, which is what lives today, that ethnic type, they were interfertile, and we carry their genes to this day, showing they had to be of the same human species. There's just some of these groups that, again, separated at the Tower of Babel and had different ethnic appearance because of the separation of the genetic pie, so to speak, but they're still human, and therefore interfertile, and the genetics proves that to this day. So the Neanderthal model endorsed by Eric Trinkaus looks a lot more like a modern human. In fact, one woman says, give him a shave, a bath, haircut, put him in a business suit, I'd go out to dinner with him. Really doesn't look that bad. Okay, now here we have the forensic reconstruction of a Jane Doe child. The same principles that forensic anthropologists use for the police. When they find like a skeleton of a Jane Doe, we can figure out that it was a female, it was a girl. But what did she look like in the flesh? Well, they use these proven principles to make these models so that people might recognize who the dead person was. They did this with a Neanderthal child, and look what we get. She could have been any of our children today. She certainly doesn't look like an ape girl. So in conclusion, we find that all that they have been able to make any arguments about is primarily varieties of Australopithecus, which now that we've found the remaining anatomical data and the computerized studies on them, they are simply ruled out as being anything but extinct apes. On the other hand, we find that Homo erectus, Neanderthal, and Cro-Magnon are all varieties of true humans, just different ethnic varieties within the human family, and were infertile, proving they're the same human species. That means after more than 150 years of intensive investigation all over the world and many millions of dollars spent trying to prove it, the elusive ape man in between has never been found. And there's a good reason for that. Things that never existed are very hard to find. Okay? That's why. That's the most logical deduction. Otherwise, they surely would have found it by now. But we have either apes or men, but not a clear-cut ape man after all this time. Now, Lord Sully Zuckerman, again, this atheist evolutionist expert in the field, he said, for example, no scientist could logically dispute the proposition that man, without having been involved in any act of divine creation. So he's saying, I don't believe in creation. But he says man nonetheless must have evolved from some ape-like creature in a very short space of time, speaking in geological terms, without leaving any fossil traces of the steps of the transformation. So he says, I believe in evolution, but I have to honestly say there's no evidence for it. But I believe it anyway. You know, blind faith. If ever there's a definition of blind faith, here it applies. So the biblical definition of faith is found in Hebrews 11:1. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. However, the definition for faith in the evolutionist religion of atheism and evolutionism goes a little different. For them, the evolutionist definition of faith is this. Now, faith is the substance of fossils hoped for, the evidence of links not seen. As they admit, they're not there. Truly a blind faith. Well, I do have this available on DVD, and I hope you'll take advantage of the materials back there. In conclusion, when we objectively look at the evidence after more than 150 years of intensive investigation all over the world trying to find evidence of human evolution, we find that still the most accurate, the most up-to-date, the most credible and believable statement ever made on human origins is still found in the ancient book, the Bible, where it says, God created them, male and female he created them, in his image he created them. And we have always been that way, and that's why there's no links between us and ape-like creatures. They never existed. It's hard to find things that don't exist, but creation predicts that. So I thank you for your attention tonight. I've gone a little longer than I normally do, but I hope it's been helpful to you. And Pastor Jeremy, if you're here somewhere, I'll call you up to close us out with a word of prayer. Thank you so much for coming out on a Sunday night for a special service. Appreciate it.